The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
America would never do for you, my lord.
Well, I don't know. A lot of opportunities over there, you know. Right kind of fella. You do very well for yourself there, I think, Ruggles.
Me, my lord.
Oh, yes, I forgot to tell you. You're going out to America.
America, my lord. A country of slavery.
You know, that's all finished, I believe. Some fellow called Pocahontas or something did something about it.
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Loose Cannons coming at ya. Today we're going to be discussing 1935's The Ruggles of Red Gap.
It's just Ruggles.
Directed by... Okay.
Not The Ruggles.
Directed by one of many Ruggles. I mean, we're going to be discussing one of many Ruggles of Red Gap. Not a specific one. Just... Any Ruggles you choose, directed by Leo McCary. And joining us today is me. You probably recognize my voice. This is Ruben, and also Basil and Patrick.
Yeah,
no
yeah,
Ilya, yeah, no guest yeah. host.
Back again. Podcasting. Back again.
Say hello.
Hello.
Patrick.
Hello, Patrick.
Basil here. What's up? Yeah, I was going to say, they should have really called it Ruggles Goes to Red Gap, because he's not of Red Gap, really.
Well, I guess he is, in the end, he decides yep. he wants to be, but...
He becomes... So the ending, the title is actually a spoiler. He becomes Ruggles of Red Gap.
Mm-hmm. It's like, in Inception, you wouldn't have known... that the movie was that incepting things that hadn't been called Inception.
That's
true. But before we do that, let's do this little segment we like to call Heralds and Announcements. Patrick.
I would like to... I'm trying to decide if I want to herald or denounce a film... I think I'm going to, because I've seen like a bunch of documentaries in the last few days, and I've been kind of on the fence about most of them. But I think you know what? No, I don't want to. I don't want to herald or denounce any of those. I'm actually going to go back and I'm going to denounce Disney's The Jungle Book. Not the one from the 50s or 60s or whatever it was, the one that came out this year.
Wait, didn't you denounce that on the last episode?
Did I? I couldn't remember if I'd done that.
Somebody denounced it last time.
It was probably me.
As much of the podcast talking about... How bad it was. As we talked about.
Wowzers. So I've already denounced that one. I'm kind of holding a lot of my cards close to my chest, though, because and we're so near the end of the year.
It's going to come up again in the Worst of the Year podcast.
Sure is.
It's going to be denounced for a fourth time.
Yeah, well, still fuck that movie. But, let's...
That's got to be the most denounced movie of our podcast.
Yeah, I'm holding a lot of my cards close to my chest due to end of the year stuff. So, I don't have anything to herald or denounce, really, that I specifically hate or love.
I am not going to herald a movie exactly, but I'm going to herald how much my opinion changed of The Maltese Falcon. 2 years ago, we played it at Fifth Ave, and I watched it then, and I didn't really like it. I was doing the preview screening, and as happened a lot when I worked at that job, if a movie didn't grab me right away, I would just kind of sit in the theater and like be on my phone a lot and not really pay that much attention. And at the end of it, I was just like, I don't like this movie at all. But then for my book club, we're going to be reading one of my favorite books, James Naremore's film noir book called More Than Night, Film Noir in Its Context. And my girlfriend wanted to watch some of the film noir movies that he talks about before we read the book so that she would have more context for his context. So we watched The Maltese Falcon because obviously that's sort of considered the genesis, and she'd never seen it before, and I liked it. Bogart's like kind of a weird sociopath in it. I can't tell if that's on purpose or not, but I like it. Like he's like really weird and manipulative to everyone, and at one point someone says, Sam, you're too slick for your own good, and that seems like what he is. Like, he's just like always like really sort of aggressively controlling every situation that he's in, and Bogart really plays him like in a pretty mean way. Like, he gets this glare in his eyes when he's mad at someone that I'm like, man, this is like a serial murder stare. He just wants to kill you right now, but with his really aggressive wordplay. But so yeah, I enjoyed it. It's still got a huge amount of weird problems, but it's like less serious than I remembered. Like, it's like it doesn't take any of what's going on very seriously, and it's like a pretty silly movie, but it seems like a pretty intentionally silly movie, and that's a nice breath of fresh air to realize, considering how seriously a lot of people take film noir in general. And it's like gross men and manipulative women, but this movie is just like pretty ridiculous and over the top about it.
Yeah, I liked that as well at my rewatch of it too.
Just to be clear, you didn't think the movie was good enough on its own to herald, but you did think the difference between what you used to think of the movie and what you think of it now,
yeah,
was worth heralding?
Yeah, because to me it's still just like a 3-star movie, because there's some really big problems. Like, Peter Lorre's character is like hyper-feminized in a way that feels pretty gross, like right down to like his costuming, and like when he pulls a gun, it's like a tiny like .22 pistol, and like all the other men in the movie have like big guns, and it's like, ooh, like he's a gay guy, so he has a woman's gun, and I'm like, I don't like that at all. But overall, I was like surprised how much I liked it, because I wasn't really looking forward to it, but I was like, well, if you haven't seen this movie, we should probably watch it, because it's kind of the cornerstone of a big chunk of this book, so. Yep.
Nice.
Good times.
The movie I'm going to herald is not a rewatch, but for those who've never heard of it, I have an app on my phone called Time Hop that I check pretty regularly, which tells me, you know, my social media posts of exactly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago or something like that. And apparently, this I watched almost exactly at the same time an Albert Brooks movie called Real Life last year, as I watched an Albert Brooks movie called Modern Romance this year, like the same week I watched them. And I heralded that last year on a podcast. I'm heralding Modern Romance this year on a podcast. It's a really funny movie, just like Real Life. I don't think it's quite as thematically dense as that movie, with its kind of ideas about real life and movie making, and how movie making has shaped our idea of what real life is supposed to be, and how real life pushes against that by not by being real.
Right.
And, you know, just like that movie, this movie has kind of an ironic title in that the main coupling that the movie is about is sort of not romantic at all. There's not really that much romance going on. In fact, like, basically the beginning is Albert Brooks meeting this woman at a diner, and he breaks up with her, and in that conversation we know that he's broken up with her, or she's broken up with him multiple times in the past, and she's like, don't call me. She's like, I don't want to do this again. And so then basically within like 24 hours he's calling her again until they get back together. And I guess what I think is kind of really unique and special about this movie, and about what I've seen of Albert Brooks' career in general, is that he's very critical of this sort of male solipsism that I find interesting. I don't want to say that he's sympathetic to it, because I think that's one of the problems with Woody Allen's career, who I think makes very similar films that don't quite land for me, because he wants to pretend like the fact that he knows that he's neurotic or whatever and self-obsessed is a meaningful positive in his benefit. It's more like, I don't know, it's more like that Verhoeven-y thing where it's not like he's sympathetic, but like he understands like how this happens,
right,
and understands that it's, you know, something that he is guilty of, probably himself. You know, the fact that he sort of always makes his characters like pretty similar to him. I don't remember the name of the character in this movie, but, you know, he works in films, he's an editor. It's like, it seems like in both of those movies in real life, where his name is literally Albert Brooks, although he's obviously playing a fictionalized version of himself, and in this movie where he works in the film industry, that he's like pretty upfront about the fact that these characters are at least representations of a part of him, that feels, I don't know, pretty good, pretty funny. I'll point out, one of the funniest jokes to me is, so he's broken up with this person, he's obviously having a hard time dealing with it, he decides to immediately call someone and ask her out on a date, you know, to try to help facilitate getting over it. And he gets in the car with, like, he picks her up the next night to take her on the date, and they're driving around for a while, like having an awkward conversation. It's like a pretty long scene of them driving, and then he just pulls back up to the apartment that he picked her up from, and he's like, I can't do this, get out of the car. So I laughed really hard at that part. And I won't spoil the ending, but the little post, like, text that it shows up, the, like, pre-credits text, kind of like American Graffiti or something like that, is definitely the best or my favorite of that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Really good movie. Strongly recommend it. Definitely gonna finish watching Albert Brooks's over and see whether or not he has any more gems in there, because so far, very strong movies. The three movies he's directed that I've seen are Real Life, which is one of my favorite movies ever, About a Romance, which I think is really, really good, Mother, which I thought was very funny, but I saw that a long time ago.
Yeah, I really want to see, I can never remember the title of it, but the road trip one,
Lost in America.
Yeah, I kept wanting to say Coming to America, but I knew that wasn't right.
That's not the one.
Nope.
Yeah, they're all on Netflix right now, people.
Yeah.
Go check them out.
They're not all on Netflix. Some of them are on Netflix. Modern Romance is on Netflix. That's why I watched that one next.
I watched,
but I don't think Lost in America is.
Oh, was it? I thought it was. I feel like I've been seeing it on there. Maybe they took it off, but I feel like I saw,
I think there were more at the beginning of the year, and there are less now.
Yeah, because I definitely watched Real Life on there. And I know I saw Lost in America and Modern Romance and Mother on there at some point recently, so.
Yeah, Mother's still on there for sure. I saw that one like the other day, but I mean, I didn't watch it, but I saw that it was there.
Yeah.
All right. Time to talk about Ruggles Goes to Red Gap.
Yeah. So,
which was Basil's pick?
Yep. So I'm gonna do the plot. It's pretty straightforward. The main character Ruggles is a English valet, and his employer loses him in a poker game to a sort of cowboyish, like a West Coast millionaire who got rich in oil and livestock and a bunch of other stuff, named Egbert. And he doesn't actually want him because he thinks that it would be unmanly and that everyone would laugh at him to have an English valet. But his wife is very obsessed with, now that they have this all this money, trying to fit in with high society, and that English valet would help them do that. So Ruggles comes to Red Gap, and which is where they live in Washington, and sort of a fish out of water for the first part of it, him trying to become accustomed to all these American ways that he doesn't quite understand. But then he's inspired by the American sense of freedom and individualism, and decides to strike out on his own and opens up a restaurant, and it's a big success, and then the movie's over. Ruben, what did you think of this movie?
I didn't like it at all. There's a part early in the movie where the aristocrat mentions that they're going to America before he's told the valet that it's just him who's going to America with this couple. And the valet goes, "America, the land of slavery." And then almost immediately in the conversation, then the aristocrat mentions that he lost the valet in a game of poker, essentially making him a piece of property as well. And like that kind of irony I thought was going to be kind of interesting, about like the idea that class and wealth in its own way is sort of like a bureaucratic form of slavery. Like that it's obviously, I want to be clear, not as bad as slavery. But that it's like the sort of thousand paper cuts version of, like, you know, getting stabbed in the gut. And like that comparison, I was like, oh, that's really smart. It's going to be interesting if this film is about that. And then it takes a pretty sharp turn into America is a great nation for everyone to be equal with each other. And I was like, oh, I'm not interested in this at all, especially because they just mentioned that it's the land of slavery. There are people still alive when this movie both takes place and was made who had slaves. And we're talking about, it takes place in the Jim Crow era, you know, and there's one black person in the movie and one Chinese person in the movie who are also servants, but they don't get the chance to succeed and be on equal footing. And I don't think the film is aware of that irony whatsoever. And, it's not particularly funny. I laughed once or twice, but by the end, it wasn't visually interesting, and it wasn't funny, and I was pretty much out of the what the theme seemed to be headed for. So I'm not even 100% sure what happened in the last 20 minutes, because I was about to fall asleep and was just sort of staring off into the distance. I know that he opens a restaurant and he throws a guy out of the restaurant, but that's about all that I caught of it. I think this is the third Leo McCarey movie I've seen. Duck Soup I liked a lot, but Duck Soup is just basically straight jokes from beginning to end.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, the jokes are written and probably pretty much composed by the Marx Brothers. And then the other movie of his I've seen, The Awful Truth, is sort of the same thing, and that I felt like at the time it thinks that it's kind of like a left-leaning movie, but is actually like pretty conservative and patriarchal, and about how men and women need to stay married and stuff like that. Mm. And I was like, I don't like this movie at all. So I feel like I might be done with Leo McCarey.
Yeah, you've actually seen a fourth one that you don't even remember.
Is it Little Caesar?
No, Make Way for Tomorrow.
Yeah,
which we did for the podcast.
I was going to say, Leo McCarey gets
some play. I didn't really like that movie either, although I find that one considerably less conservative than The Awful Truth in this one.
That's true. Patrick?
I also didn't like this movie, although I'm probably not as much as Ruben. I'll say that the social problems are definitely there with this movie. It's pretty standard in all of its roles for people. And there's also a part where there's even a mansplaining scene where Ruggles talks to the woman that he's sort of wooing, where he's like, some of the best chefs in the world are men. And he's like trying to tell her how to do everything in the kitchen. And I was just like, oh boy, this is uncomfortable. And it's like men and women can both cook, but like, you know, I don't know. It's still like reinforcing that stereotype of like women want to stay in the kitchen all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's even worse because I think the actual line is all of the best chefs in the world have been men.
All of the best chefs in the world have been
not
men.
Even most of them.
Which is a weird thing that is still sort of believed today. Mm-hmm. And something that I like about Ratatouille, for instance, is that they draw attention to that fact at one point when Janine Garofalo's character is like, look at this restaurant. How many other women do you see here?
Mm-hmm. And she talks about, you know, how she has to work way harder than anyone else to earn her place there. Yeah. So she won't be good old Linguini.
Yeah. I actually like kind of enjoyed the humor in some places. Like I liked Charles Laughton's performance in general. I thought he had like a very weird way of delivering everything and like playing. He sort of played to the audience like he was in a play. So he like kind of like plays out to the camera all the time when he does reactions to stuff. And I was like, this is kind of like a weird thing that I don't feel like I've seen very much of in movies, but I especially like a lot of the I don't know what you would call them, like colloquialisms, I guess, that Egbert comes up with when he's talking about his suit and the way that Effie makes him dress, and you know, like the way that Ruggles acts sometimes, where he calls him like, or in him and the other guy like going back and forth, like calling each other you old horny toad or you old sly fox or something like that. Like, I don't know, I kind of liked how goofy they're made out to be in those scenes. And I also thought the scene with the where the dog kept coming into the house when Ruggles was trying to cook, I really liked Charles Lund's delivery of the line and the way that he like ran around the kitchen. Like, he wasn't even like looking at the dog, he was just like looking up, like he couldn't even bear to look at it. But I enjoyed some of that. I do think that the message is really muddled though, especially that he in the end decides to call his restaurant the Anglo-American Grill, where I was like, oh boy, this is like white people shit to the nth power. Like, it's crazy. I mean, it's supposed to be like this, like, oh, England and America joining together, but it's like, it's just like different shades of white people. Like, you've completely glossed over the fact that, you know, and it also is in like an old Chinese restaurant too. So it's basically like building that on the failure of, you know, another immigrant's, and he succeeds because, you know, he's a white person.
Yep. Yeah, they make that very explicit, that someone in the town murdered that Chinese guy because his food was too Chinese.
Yeah,
I'm like, that's gross. That's not a good joke.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, yeah, I'm on the same page as Ruben. I really, really disliked the movie. I didn't like looking at it. I didn't like most of the humor, and I didn't like this idea of, you know, America and what it means to be American. The only thing I liked about it was the sort of somewhat still true part with the Gettysburg Address, where it was like, America loves freedom, but is completely ignorant of its own history.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't think that was funny.
But then it goes on forever with him quoting it and everyone staring at him, and I'm like, this movie hasn't earned this moment. Like,
yeah. I mean, I think both parts go on forever. Like, mm-hmm. the bartender asks, like, 17 people whether or not they know the Gettysburg Address. Yeah. And I'm like, all right, I get the joke. And then when he delivers the Gettysburg Address, it's supposed to be, like, really stirring and inspirational. And it's like, this is what America is really about. And it's like, how can you have that immediately follow the joke that you just had? Mm-hmm. Like, how can you say that America embraces freedom when it knows nothing about
right.
it? You know, they've embraced it in the most superficial way, which, like, if this film was that, that could be a really interesting, like, critique. Like, this film that's about how sort of everyone in their own way is convinced that they're not part of a system that really, like, abuses an underclass for whatever reason, but they're all unaware of the fact, or, you know, like, the fact that they all think that because they have their own whatever pretensions or things, that that makes them above that. Mm-hmm. And they can point out, like, oh, in Butler, in Britain, they have, like, an aristocracy, and that makes them bad, you know, and then he looks to America and he's like, oh, they recently had slavery, so that makes them bad.
Right.
And it's like, no, you're all bad. And you're just using, like, looking down on other people as a way to not notice all of the deep flaws of your own system.
Right. That would be a much more incisive and interesting movie. And, unfortunately.
I noticed that this has the Hays Code stamp, or the motion picture code stamp at the beginning of it. So I guess this is firmly in that era. But I also noticed that the number of the certificate seemed to be pretty low. So this seemed like one of the, like, maybe the first movies that was granted a certificate. So it was like, oh, yeah. They were like, this has our seal of approval because, you know, you don't mess with American values or whatever. And so, yeah. That almost definitely played a role in stuff that they, you know, may have changed, or, you know, I don't know, this is the 30s, so it maybe didn't change that much from what the original mm-hmm. intent of the movie and all that was.
They started really enforcing the Hays Code in, like, 1933, so it had only been a couple of years of strict enforcement. I also noticed that this movie is sponsored by the NRA.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also sort of weird in that there's, like, almost no guns except for in that weird sequence where Ruggles is dreading going to America and he pictures of it as just, like, an endless slaughter between cowboys and Native Americans or whatever, which was also a gross joke.
It's
yep, again, that's a thing that could have been interestingly critical, that, you know, like, one, that it presents the idea of, like, that, you know, American cultural history has both presented this idea that's not totally true about the West and, like, how the West was, and this, you know, sort of overly manly idea that's just not actually how the West was settled for the most part, and, you know, also that it sort of glosses over, you know, the horrible genocide by making, like, the cowboys out to be queer heroes and the natives out to be queer villains. But him, the way that he finds out that that imagery is not true is not him finding out the reality, but finding out a different thing that America sells is its truth, which is this, you know, land of freedom, that an opportunity that they've, you know, implanted in this area that wasn't there before.
Yep. full of self-made men, raising livestock and mining and getting oil, and nothing bad ever happens to people, except for that one Chinese guy who got murdered.
And all those Chinese people that got murdered building the railroads, and, you know.
Well, yeah, but they don't even exist in the movie.
It's true.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I was going to say that Love and Friendship handles that in a much funnier way when there's like an offhanded joke where someone's talking about having to go to America and how horrifying and barbaric it seems and how they don't want to go. And just the, I don't know. I mean, Whit Stillman's a very...
Specifically fun. Connecticut.
Yeah, exactly. One of the most upper crust and white parts of America still seems too horrifying for a real aristocrat in Britain.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess, I mean, this is, you know, a complaint, again, that's just, like, still true today, but this sort of, like, ease of, like, redneck humor, I guess, is the best thing to call it. Like, the fact that there never seems to be any self-awareness as to whether or not this is an okay thing to make fun of. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, you're basically talking about the culture in which people were raised, and we've come to the point where, for the most part, we understand, or most people seem to understand, like, not to make fun of people for their customs and diction and stuff like that. But apparently when it comes to poor whites or poor whites who have become rich, that's okay.
Yep.
That's just, you know, like, it makes fun of the wife, but essentially her goal is something that the film implicitly agrees with, of civilizing her husband, because it makes fun of him constantly for the way that he talks and acts.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it also valorizes his manliness, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, it does seem to be on his side a bit also, because it seems like they want you to still think, like, oh, yeah, but the Americans are fun. Like, they're not all, like, stuck up like all those people in Paris. Like, they know how to have a good time. And, you know, they in the end, are like, you know, they're like the real men in the room or whatever.
I mean, I think it's like a have your cake and eat it thing where it's, you know, or yeah. like that tweet about satire, like, just make we make fun of everyone. That's satire. Like, we just don't have a political position.
Oh, I thought you were going to reference another tweet, a kind of Tripler tweet that I really love, which is, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was basically like, anyone snobbier than me is a hipster, and anyone less snobby than me is a frat bro. I'm the perfect level
of snobbiness.
You know, class. Yeah, of like class level of irony of, you know, that's kind of the position that this film lands. It's like, oh, you're a, you know, old, upper crusty, they're, you know, too stiff or whatever, but like also, you know, don't make jokes about pigs with side pockets and stuff like that and looking like a dead rooster because you look like an idiot.
Right. And yeah, and the movie comes down like pretty hard on this weird like marriage of sensibilities or whatever, like the Anglo-American grill, and then like the Earl comes back to try and reclaim Ruggles and doesn't do it, but instead ends up marrying like a working class American woman. So it's like, this is the best of both worlds. We get the, you know, dignity and history of the British aristocracy, but wedded with the freedom and, you know, liveliness of American values. Like kicking someone in the butt to make them leave your restaurant.
essentially Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Ah, how far we've come since 1935. But, yeah, I mean, it's, what was I gonna say?
This movie is extraordinarily well rated on Letterboxd by my friends.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's one thing I was gonna make fun of. I remember, you know, Rotten Tomatoes does those, like, top five movie interviews or whatever, where they, like, interview a celebrity and ask them their top five movies, and they either write about it or record, like, a little thing talking about it. And one of them was Edward Norton, and he was talking about this movie, how he saw Barton Fink, and there's a part where, what's his name? Who plays Monk,
Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah, he's a movie producer, and he yells at Barton for being too slow writing the movie. And he's like, "This is a B picture. What do you think this is? Ruggles of Red Gap?" And as implying that that was like kind of a prestige movie at the time. But so Edward Norton in his interview is like, "Yeah, I saw that and I hadn't heard of that movie, so I went down and checked it out. And it's great. Now it's one of my five favorite movies." And I was like, "You're a liar, Edward Norton. You just wanted to reference some obscure movie that most people who were watching it probably hadn't heard of. There's no way, like, after a long day at the set, you're like, ah, I'm going to sit down and watch one of my favorite movies, Ruggles of Red Gap."
Yeah. I mean, I think this was a prestige picture, though. I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
It was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. So,
for sure, I believe that.
I mean, Charles Lawton was a prestige actor, wasn't he?
I think so, yeah. I wish.
Speaking of, I disagree with Patrick. I hate his performance. Like, I couldn't even look at his face most of the time. And it's like, again, I mean, part of this is just, like, where the film goes. Like, maybe if this were just a broad comedy, like a fish out of water comedy, it's like British butler raised in this very proper environment goes to, you know, the wild west of America and, you know, has this like culture shock, but, and then his like broad acting would maybe sort of like work a bit, but like he's acting really broadly in this movie that really feels like it's trying to champion the equality-ness of America and like multiple scenes, and I'm like, that's not the movie that this performance should be in.
Right. He does a lot of stuff with his eyes, which I found very disconcerting. It's a lot of like.
I liked what he was doing with his eyes. That was one of my favorite parts. Because it's so weird. Like a lot of the stuff, like
he's doing
a lot of eye rolling and a lot of like looking to the side and like mugging a little bit.
Yeah, I was gonna say it is like an extremely weird performance for 1935. Like, aside from somebody like Groucho Marx or something like that, I can't imagine almost any actor choosing this performance, and that he chose to do it, like, in defiance of everyone else's performance is an extremely weird decision. Yeah. So I sort of like that he did that, that he's just like, I'm going to do
that
this.
That sounds like Charles Lawton. Yeah. Based on my experience of The Night of Hunter and what I know about behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so like, that is like a funny idea, but it's only funny to me like in a meta way. Like, I agree with Ruben that I found it very just like unsettling to look at, and made it hard to pay attention during certain scenes because I was like, this is really intense what he's doing. But
yeah, I mean, I guess Groucho Marx is a good point of comparison, because the Marx Brothers movies that I have seen, I like Groucho Marx in, and he tends to usually be surrounded by people who are acting normally, but that there's like a way that the film is set up to like, you know, make the fact that he's separate from everybody, I don't know, work better than it does in this film.
Yeah, I mean, like, they all act, like, way more over the top than anyone else in their movies. And I think that, like, part of how that works is that, especially in their early movies, the movie is really on their side structurally. Like, it keeps trying to introduce other things, like a normal plot, but then they'll just have a sequence that's, like, totally irrelevant or just, like, abandon plot lines, like, halfway through and there's no resolution. So, like, even in the movie structure, it's like, ah, we don't care about this shit. Like, there's the normal shit, which is how movies are made and how people normally act in movies, and we don't care about that. We just want to see Groucho Marx make weird faces and
Harpo
run around.
Yeah, their movies are more like a structure to fit, like, vaudeville bits into. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why it works, is because they're just doing vaudeville on screen, which is what their, you know, what their performances are built for. And where this movie is more like a, I don't know, it's kind of trying to be serious in a way. And so, you know, it's not really built for that, like, that vaudevillian, like, playing, because a lot of it feels like he's just, like, playing to an audience that isn't there. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really built for him to do that. Like, nobody else in the movie is acknowledging that at all. But and he doesn't have, like, you know, a lot of very scripted jokes too. It's not built on, like, wordplay or anything like that, like Marx Brothers movies are.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, I just really like watching him in the movie. I think, I don't know, for some reason that weirdness is what actually made it funny to me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess him and the dissonance. You know, him and the colloquialisms of Egbert.
I liked some of those, and I liked how, like, increasingly odd they were. Like, I think at some point he's like, "You old cup of coffee," or
yeah.
Call him.
I have to mention this. One of the, if not the funniest part of the movie to me, is the fact that the actor who plays Egbert's last name is actually Ruggles.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But he does not play the person named Ruggles. And I was like, how rare of a last name, and yet they...
He's the actual Ruggles of Red Gap.
Yep.
It's true.
Yeah, I noticed that too, and for, like, a good, like, 5 minutes of the movie, I was like, wait, is Charlie Ruggles Ruggles? But then I was like, no, I'm pretty sure. And then I was just like, I kept doubting myself, so then I finally looked it up and I was like, no, that's what I thought, it's Charles Lawton. But, like, why is there another person named Ruggles? Like, in my head I was like, oh, maybe this is, like, a famous stage character and then they made him into a movie character and Charlie Ruggles is just, like, known for being Ruggles. But then I was like, no, but it looks like Charles Lawton, can't be right. And it's very confusing. I sort of want to know the genesis. Maybe that guy really is, like, played Ruggles on the stage, and he usually acts like an English butler. That would make me like his performance a lot if he's just, like, he's pretty convincing in his gung-ho, loving to drink whiskey, calling people...
Yeah.
Cups of coffee away. But
yeah, and I mean, they also play the kind of, like, the shrewish wife stereotype, which is,
mm-hmm,
you know, as old as Shakespeare at least.
Yeah.
So I mean, it again, it's another, like, bad stereotype that gets fit into the story. That
again, yeah, and they dress her in ridiculous dresses. Like, they make it pretty obvious that she's, like, also a class imposter, that she's very obsessed with this idea of, like, getting access to high society, but that she doesn't actually know how to do it at all. Similar to Stella Dallas, which also came out in the 1930s.
Yeah, I feel like this must have been a much bigger deal back then than it is now. Like, just the like, small differences in class, because it seems like this was something that people made a lot of movies about. And so
it was during the Depression, so everybody wanted to be rich because everyone was so horribly poor. And being rich seemed like a way to escape your awful, awful life. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, it's still a thing, sort of. I don't know. I mean, there's still a pretty big divide between, you know, people who are ostentatiously rich, like Donald Trump, and the other people who are just as wealthy, but try to hide it by driving Subarus around and wearing modest clothing.
Yeah, but I feel like it's not as big a deal as it once was, though, because it's, like, now there's such a more dire divide, I guess, and we've actually, like, gotten, like, I guess real social inequities out in the open more now, like, you know.
Yeah, and also the nouveau riche one. It's way more cool to be ostentatiously rich now than it is to be rich and hide it in a conservative way. Like, it's way cooler to, you know, spend $50,000 at the club one night drinking $500 bottles of champagne and whatnot than it is to just live in a huge mansion in Connecticut and drive yourself to work every day in a small car. But no, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
I don't have a problem with it. Like, I don't... Being rich is awful either way.
Yeah, well,
rich people are gross. Yeah. So,
as you say, like,
hide it doesn't make it any better that you
I feel like millions
of dollars you don't need.
I feel like there's so many other problems. Like, we would never make a movie that was like this nitpicky about like small social structures today. Like, we wouldn't be like, oh, these people have a little bit more money than these people, so they're different. Can't we all just get along and be together? And it's like, who cares about that now?
I would say that ostentatiously rich people are actually better because they're not setting their money on fire when they spend
it. Yeah, that's like, true.
A thing is being made and sold and served. Their money is going to places. People, you know, buy a Subaru and then sit on it or, you know, whatever, the rest of their money, then that's obviously the worst person who's just like keeping their money, you know, taking it with them or something. I don't even know. But like, you know, when you buy whatever the fanciest bottle of champagne is, Cristal or something like that, you know, someone made that, someone raised the grapes, someone, you know, sold it to a winery. You know, maybe more of that money is going to the CEO and they're just passing money back and forth against the top amount, but at least some of that money is going to people who did stuff, you know?
That's true. it's a very fair point.
But I mean, I certainly think, you know, someone like, and I've mentioned this before, if not on this podcast, someone like Keanu Reeves is way better, who lives like a pretty, you know, I mean, he's still very rich. Like, he has an apartment in New York City that he owns, which I'm sure is, you know, had to have cost over $1 million. But that, you know, he basically lives on like a less than $100,000 a year income and gives most of the rest of it away.
Yeah. That's a cooler way to be rich for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, I would say like the gradations are not, based on what I know about most luxury brands, it's like not, I don't know, you know, because like if you buy something that costs like $50,000 versus like something that costs like $100, like the amount that the person who made it is getting paid, like they, most of those luxury brands still like make their clothing in like really destitute parts of the world and, you know, probably underpay their workers or whatever. So it's like only increasing profit margins if you buy like a Dolce & Gabbana shirt versus like, you know, some other kind of button-down shirt that was only, you know, $40 or whatever. But
Yeah. You're paying.
Because in that case, you're buying a name, not like actual quality difference.
Yeah, definitely.
But like,
I mean, a slight difference quality between... difference for sure. Having touched those shirts, they are super soft, but.
But the difference between like a Subaru and a Lamborghini is actually a difference between like a machine and a craftsman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. This sort of discussion came up, not to get too far off topic, when someone, a friend of mine who's been working in construction for the last year, told me that what they were working on now was that someone decided to build a guest house for their lake house that they only, you know, visit a couple of times per year. So, and then, of course, they only maybe have guests like once a year. So they basically have this house that's used like 1 week out of the year. And they were like, that's so wasteful. And I was like, they didn't set that money on fire. Like, you're getting paid. The architect got paid. The people who sold the building materials got paid. Like, I mean, they I would prefer if they donated it to, you know, the Planned Parenthood or the Trans Law Center, because I think they do better work. But it's...
Yeah.
I don't know if wasteful is the right word for people
I think,
paying for stuff to get made.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think what they're saying is that, like, you know, oh, they have two large houses, and there are some families that have zero houses. And so, you know, maybe you could give that to, like, Habitat for Humanity to build a house for someone else instead of having two houses, because why do you need two houses?
If they said it's selfish or cruel, I would have no problem with that, but I don't...
Yeah, I mean,
buying things is how a capitalist economy works, and even if I don't agree that capitalism is a good system that we want to, you know, keep for a long time, not spending your money is far more selfish and wasteful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We just need to get rid of capitalism, though, because we're producing too much. We should be paying people not to work. It's too much stuff in the world. But it's the only way that the system works, is if you keep making stuff so people keep buying stuff, and then... Because
yeah.
You can't just have nothing. Fun. A great conversation we've gotten to, thanks to Ruggles of Red Gap.
Build stuff so that it breaks down in a few years so people have to get a new one.
We've gone way past this at this point, but the fact that I know that Ruggles, the actor, doesn't play Ruggles, the character, but whenever something kind of similar like that happens, it makes me think of when I watched The Thin Red Line in college. And we were kind of MST3K-ing it. I mean, I kind of like the movie now, but at the time I really, really didn't like it, like, pretty quickly, and so we were mostly making fun of it. And there's a part where Nick Nolte, like, tells John Cusack to, like, go over this hill, and he's, like, a badass soldier, and he's like, John, I need you to take that hill. And we had this joke we were making, like that wasn't the character's name in the script, but that Nick Nolte just couldn't remember the character's name and kept calling him by his real name. And they're like, no, Nick, his name is Nick. And it's like, no, that's my name. It's like, this is a pretty funny night.
Oh, Charlie Ruggles isn't bringing up baby.
What?
He plays Major Applegate.
Major Applegate. Mm-hmm.
He's also in Trouble in Paradise. He's been in a lot of things that have been heralded on this podcast.
A lot of screwball comedies, huh? He seems like
not
a screwball
this movie, though.
He seems like a screwball comedy character to me.
Yeah, this movie could have used a lot more screwballness and a lot less stirring renditions of the Gettysburg Address.
But
it is pretty impressive that he memorized the entire Gettysburg Address from, like, sitting down and reading one book, though.
I mean, I guess so. Like, it doesn't actually make any sense for his character unless he memorized it the day before, because previous to that, he was very content with his life as a butler.
Yeah.
So he wasn't like this butler who was dreaming of freedom and reading Lincoln and being like, ah, oh, if only, but too bad I'm stuck in this horrible system. He's extremely happy with this system and initially resistant to leaving it, but...
Again, another track that the movie could have taken that would have been interesting would have been about how, you know, people raised potentially in a certain environment that is actually bad will resist changing their bad environment to something better because they think that that's how things should be.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what they were going for here, but they don't really put it across well because he's at first, like, trying to, like, not sit while Egbert is sitting and, like, opening doors for him, and Egbert's like, no, don't do that, Conflabbit, and he's like, sit down and have a drink with me. He like, just doesn't want to. He's like, it'll look bad or whatever. But they don't really, like, put across too much the idea that he, like, is really resistant.
Yeah, and I think that the way that they go about it, which is that it's not like, in some ways the movie is trying to be generalizing that America is this land of freedom and opportunity and that anyone can succeed, like, in the great hypocrisy of that at this moment in time.
Right.
You know, makes it almost impossible for that to land. You know, whereas if it's specific to him and we, like, really know this character of Ruggles and, like, his obsession with British propriety, and the movie is about him specifically learning things that are actually better. Whereas, like, a lot of the movie, it's like, you know, when he sits down with him, it's not like, I don't know, that's an enjoyable experience. He just does something different than... I mean, standing up isn't, like, the worst thing in the world or something.
Right.
I mean, it isn't... it is nicer to be sitting down. It doesn't seem like he gains anything from that freedom except for not being a butler anymore.
Right. and it happened... I mean, well, partly this movie has, like, a zillion plots and, like, no plot, sort of, because, like, it introduces that thing, but then it drops that pretty quickly, just like it introduces the fish out of water thing, but then he just, like, fits in really well, and then they just, like, have to keep starting the plot over, like, for a brief period in the movie. Everyone thinks he's a colonel, and so you think that it's going to be, like, some kind of strange, like, tension with, like, a passing narrative where he's, like, mistaken for someone other than what he is, and he has to decide whether to play along with that or not play along with it. But then, like, the very next scene, he's like, oh, I should tell people who I really am. Like, I don't want to pretend to be something that I'm not. And I was like, okay, I guess that part of the movie's over. And then it comes to the part with the restaurant, and it's just like a series of, like, false starts with the plot. Like, that colonel thing starts at, like, the 50-minute mark of the movie, and I was like, oh, the plot is finally kicking in. This is what the movie's going to be about. But then it stops that right away, too, and I was like, oh. So now the movie's about him opening a restaurant, I guess? But it doesn't even start that plot until, like, an hour and 10 minutes into the movie, and I don't know, the structure of it, really, I was just like, when is the movie gonna start? Like, when am I gonna get to the part where the movie's happening?
And, you know, we already mentioned this, and I mean, this was, you know, a complaint of mine against Make Way for Tomorrow, which, I think had other good things going for it, unlike this, but this movie is so boring to look at. Leo McCary has no aesthetic uniqueness whatsoever. Like, every shot is like a medium shot of, like, two people with one person on the left side of the screen and one person on the right, usually, like, kind of facing the camera.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how long can people look at the same shot and still enjoy it? Nothing is lit differently. Like, night shots are just dark, but they're still, everything has the same even lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, I mean,
our podcast has more interesting lighting with the three different lighting situations that we have.
I'm all silhouetted.
Between us right now with like me with the kind of, you know, sullen green light of like fluorescence, you know, in the room, and then Patrick with the like shadowy but warmer sunlight coming in through the window, and then Basil's weird blue light that he always seems to have going on.
Yeah, that's just like a weird contrast thing with my webcam. Maybe it's like coming off my blue bed sheets.
Yeah, the bed's probably setting that off. Yeah.
Yeah. But,
yeah, because I have like yellow curtains up here. You can't really tell they're yellow, but they're like yellow. So I think that's what gives my room this like warm tint to it.
Yeah, your shirt, Ruben, looks like it matches the wall behind you.
Yeah. Ruben looks like he's in the Matrix. Everything's got that green tint to it.
So I'm in a Wachowski film. Patrick's in an Alfonso Cuarón film, and Basil's in a David Lynch film. Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about this movie. It was, it's not even super interesting to hate on it. I mean, it's a step up from Little Caesar, which was a movie that was just boring, and I didn't feel like had any, like, thematic things to like grab onto and you know, pull apart, but it's close in terms of just sort of not being there in a way. It's kind of like, why is this movie an important part of this time period?
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, it's not fair to hate on it because it's only a function of the movie itself, but whenever people were like saying stuff really loud, the microphones back then weren't that good yet, so it comes off really shrill and tinny, and it was like hurting my ears to hear people screaming. I was like, I don't like listening to this at all. But
yeah,
it's not really their fault.
I noticed that when I did the audio for Stella Dallas, because I like, you could hear it kind of like start to distort a little bit if I brought the audio up on it even a little, because it had this real like tinny sound at the very top, like at the very high registers. But yeah, that's just like, that's a technology issue, like that's they hadn't quite gotten the sound recording devices perfected yet.
Yep, thanks World War II. Improving microphones everywhere. What was I gonna say? Oh, yeah, the only thing that I had left to say was that I did sort of like the pretty baby singing thing with them, him trying to play the drums and get a nice voice, and I was like, I guess I could have used more singing in this movie or something that I enjoyed. But it was also weird because I've seen that scene before and I have no idea where I saw it. Like, it was in some movie, because I hadn't seen anything else from this movie ever, but I had seen that scene before, and obviously I had no idea, since it doesn't feature either of the main characters in the movie, that it was from this movie. But then once it started, I was like, huh, I've seen this scene before, but where? The closest guess is maybe it was in that Tom Anderson movie, The Thoughts That Once We Had, because he pulls from a lot of disparate movies, but it was very surreal to be like, oh, I'm watching this familiar scene that I can't place why it's familiar.
It's a little bit like the scene in Once, where they...
I have not seen Once.
There's a scene where they're in a music store, and Marquita Arglova is playing the piano, and Glenn Hansard's like playing his guitar, and they're like in a... Or no, I think maybe... I can't remember. One of them is playing the piano, and they're just like singing at the piano. Just like, they're just like hanging. Oh, we're just hanging out in the music store. Oh, we're just going to sing this, you know, Academy Award winning song here at this, just off the cuff, you know.
That was the same guy that did Begin Again, right?
Might be. I don't know much about Begin Again.
It's bad. You know that for me. It's not a good movie.
Begin Again?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as he said it once, I knew that it was going to come up.
Is that the same person?
Begin again?
The same director? I think so.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Which is part of why I'll probably never see once.
Makes sense.
Where's Sing Street? Yep.
Sing Street, Begin Again, Once, On the Edge, and Zonad.
Zonad.
Space, probably. That's definitely the movie I'm most likely to see is now.
I hope it has a lot of singing in space. Space singing.
I just think, I mean, the title Zonad is fine, but the subtitle is From Space, ... parentheses, probably, in parentheses. I feel like that's a really good subtitle.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to say. I mean, except for small notes, like, the movie opens in Paris, and so there's a shot of the Eiffel Tower, and then it cuts to, like, the room that Lawton and the Earl guy are in, and there's like also a view of the Eiffel Tower from their room, so it's like, just in case you forgot we're in Paris, there's the Eiffel Tower is still right there.
Not on a soundstage at all. Definitely in Paris.
But yeah,
if it had done it like 5 or 6 more times, then it could be the movie Pompeii. In which the volcano is like in the background of every shot for the first 30 minutes of the movie. I don't know if you know what the movie Pompeii is about, but a volcano is important.
What? What could possibly happen in a movie called Pompeii?
All right.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you are enjoying the podcast more than we enjoyed Ruggles of Red Gap. If so, please subscribe using your podcast listening application and give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which is 4.5 stars more than I'm going to give this movie. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, one thing I don't think you were on the last one, but we wanted to tell everybody what we were going to do next. It was something that Adam suggested to us, is like, tell the audience what we're going to watch next week so they can go ahead and watch it. So,
Okay. Thanks, Adam. Good idea. Let me look it up. Yeah. Is it my pick?
Yeah, it's your pick next.
All right. So we're going to be watching Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Cure. It's a rewatch for at least 2 of us.
I've never seen it.
But a movie that the last time we saw it, both Basil and I really, really liked. Mm-hmm. We'll see if that trend continues.
It's true. It's been a while for both of us, so do a fun rewatch.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks for listening again, and thanks to Adam for that suggestion as one of our few listeners. It's a good one.
All right. We'll see.
And, we will have you listen to us next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.